Hi everybody, this is Steve Savitsky, and welcome back once again to Savitsky Talks. And as always, we always have such interesting people who come on the program, people who've written articles for the Jewish Action, and today is no exception at all. As a matter of fact, we have a very interesting, wonderful person from Los Angeles, Ron Solomon, who is the Western Regional Executive Director of the American Friends of Bar Ilan University, and also a member of an OU Shul Shari Tzedek congregation in the Valley for 18 years. Ron, how are you doing today?
Very good, Steve. Thank you for that nice, warm introduction.
It's a pleasure.
Our shul is in Valley Village, by the way.
Oh, it's in Valley Village. Okay.
Right.
Well, obviously, you know, it's a very interesting. You wrote an interesting article, but you know so much about fundraising. But let's talk about the article, and let's talk about the shul you're talking about. What's interesting to me is that you were saying, well, here's a shul that is well-functioning, well-attended, has members, vibrant, and yet somehow they found themselves in a financial situation that was rather catastrophic, and you came along. We'll talk about that. But how does that happen to a shul?
Well, you know, Steve, it's an old line shul. Shari Tzedek's been around a long time, the oldest and largest Orthodox shul in the Valley. And it was going along, functioning. There was a change of rabbis about 3 or 4 years prior to this. The new rabbi came in. But when you say how does that happen, I think it's a lot of years of no one really organizing or attempting a campaign like we did. And as a result, a lot of the members got by with giving what they could get by with. I mean, there was no real education in giving. There was no setting the bar high. It was just, you know, it was a shul that everybody just assumed was going to be around.
Right.
And nobody really opened up to care about how the shul is taking care of its overhead, how it's paying its staff, how it's turning on the lights. So it went on like that for quite some time, and it went on carrying a very large mortgage for a shul of that size.
Yeah, I read about it, which was interesting. And you, as a member of the shul, probably always assumed the shul was doing pretty well financially.
Even though I'm in that field. But, you know, you go to shul, you go to daven, you know, you come to events, you see classes, you see shiurim going, you assume that things are going okay.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
And nobody really, partially because it's an interesting point. The members of the board were not eager about sharing the problems, the financial problems of the shul. Because, you know, it's not something that people really want to talk about. It's not something that, for example, would be addressed publicly, that a shul of that size and of that stature is struggling financially. But that was the position we found ourselves in.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that shuls have to be a little bit more transparent with their members and with financial issues, or do you think it's
that's a very good question. I do think it's best to be more transparent. In fact, we had some, you know, when we first started with this campaign, we had some members mention to us that they didn't feel in past when they were approached to maybe to do something, not in a formulaic way, but in just a, you know, a one project way, they didn't feel so secure that everything was transparent. Now, that may or may not be true. We don't know. But it was the perception that people felt. And that doesn't lead to, a strong giving base when you have that kind of perception.
Right. Now, I mean, how would you suggest the shuls that they... I mean, there is a kind of a fine line between being transparent enough so that people trust your numbers, but yet discreet enough, because there are certain things that not everybody has to know. So where's the line?
Well, the discretion, I think, it comes into play more in, I don't think, for example, that's a reason why you have a board there, an operating board, and I don't think that, you know, all of the all of the little problems have to be shared on a public level. But when you organize a campaign like this, a set campaign where you have a goal and you have that, those issues really should be brought out to the fore, and people should know, even people who are not capable of giving, but people should know what we're trying to do, what we're trying to accomplish here. And, you know, that was one of the, I think people did appreciate that kind of transparency, mm-hmm. to say, look, this is a project we're undertaking. We have a number of people that need help in paying membership and things of that nature, and we want to be able to help them. What we did was we devised, just so you know, before we went into the campaign, we basically, in shuls of this size, your basic shul body is more or less divided three ways. There's about a third of the shul members who are paying their full dues and can pay and not too much more. There's about a third who actually need help, and not only in paying the dues, but in paying for other things, aliyot, whatever comes up. And then there's a third that this profile would hold true in most Orthodox shuls.
Okay,
there's a third that are you know, well healed,
right.
and that can help. So what we did was in dividing this up, the third that are well healed and have the capability to help, it was a process of convincing them that they need to, or they should, and we want them to help the third that can't even pay membership. So that's basically what we tried to do.
Okay, so when you look at a rule of thumb, what percentage of the budget, the overall budget of a shul, you think should come from membership dues?
You know, that can vary from shul to shul. Usually I think that more or less two-thirds of the overall budget should come from the membership dues.
Really?
And it's that last third or so that, you know, a shul always struggles to pay, whether it's with banquets, whether it's with campaigns like we did, whether it's with capital projects, if they have the potential to do that. But generally speaking, I mean, I think it's two-thirds should be a good number to hold by.
Really? Okay,
but
that's good.
But again, that can vary
good.
From shul to shul.
Right. Now, that's good for shuls to know, when they have some kind of benchmark, at least for themselves. How do you feel about these associate members and, regular members and associate members? And if you're a regular member, what do you get for it? Do you get seats on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur? Don't you get them? You know, what's kind of the ideal situation?
Well, you're kind of, in a way, a shul is more or less forced into doing something like that, because otherwise, just, you know, don't want to pay the membership and they want to come to shul, and you really don't have a way of policing that. You know, people come to shul, they use the facilities, they use, and they might even pay membership, by the way, at another shul.
Right.
That can sometimes happen. So you have to try and create these kind of categories that are for people who, let's say a guy goes to a Sephardi shul, and that's where he prefers to daven, but he has his kids at a program at an Ashkenazi shul, so he wants to be able to use it. And you have to kind of create these kind of categories that are for non-full using members.
Yeah, it's interesting because, shuls, I think, always, whenever there's a capital campaign or building campaign, shuls could, try to raise the money. But on a regular basis, I mean, I think most shuls, count on the fact that dues are going to carry them so far. And as you said, there are probably a third of the members of the shul who probably can't pay the full amount. But how do you determine, this is not a scholarship. In a yeshiva, they have a whole scholarship committee and so on. So how do you determine, let's say dues are $1,000 and someone comes to you and they're struggling, to pay the dues. So Do you charge them $900? Do you charge them $500? How do you do that?
Well, that's based on really discreet conversations with the person, potentially talking to him about his wherewithal and trying to determine what's the best that he could do for the shul. And if usually you have one person in a shul who kind of takes up that role to say, look, if somebody's calling, I know in most shuls, if somebody's calling to say, I can't pay the membership, and you're not going to start asking for, tax forms from the IRS. You're going to try to work with it as best you can and, try and reduce it, but still try and maintain what you need to maintain to reach that two-thirds of the budget that's needed.
And how important is the role of the rabbi? I debate it all over wherever I go. The role of the rabbi when it comes to fundraising and budgets.
There have been a lot of articles published about this over the years. I forgot who wrote it. I think it might have even been, I don't remember. The rabbi as CEO. The rabbi overseeing the financial aspects of the shul, and there are a lot of rabbis who do not want to get into that role, and it's very difficult today for a shul of any size that will have a rabbi, interview a rabbi, and he may be the best rabbi in the world. He may be pastorally somebody they really want. He may be deliver the best drashas in the world, but if he can't get involved at all in the business aspects of the shul, I'm talking now about the head rabbi, if he can't be involved in the fundraising, because there are some rabbis who won't do that, you have a serious handicap today. It is very, very, it's much more difficult. In this campaign, we went literally with the list that we had, we went with the rabbi together. He was willing to do that. I made that one of the prerequisites of starting the campaign, that the rabbi has to go, he has to put the amount of time that's needed, and that the president of the shul or the chairman of the shul has to make a serious financial commitment so that he could go also to the meetings and say, I've put in this amount of money.
And have the credibility then to go out, which is great. And the thing that's also interesting about the article is that you talk about how one of the things you did is you put this beautiful plaque in the lobby. Does that really work? I mean, people like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we put one in the lobby. Not only did we put one in the lobby, but this was something that we really had to go through an education process with the members of the shul. We put one fairly good-sized plaque in the front of the shul, in the main sanctuary. And this was a source of some, I would say, controversy when we first started to do it. When people saw the names were starting, we did a mock-up on the front of the shul. And this was something some people didn't understand. Why are you doing that? It's too close to the Aron Kodesh. And there was some feeling about that, and we told them, look, it's going to be a very well-done plaque. It's going to be something that really has class. It's going to look nice. It's going to beautify the shul, if anything, because we used a background of Jerusalem stone. But it's something that we think it will entice people. It will be attractive to people to have their name on that plaque. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that a donor plaque like that was put in the actual sanctuary of Shaare Tzedek. So it didn't come easy. There was a lot of back and forth about that, a lot of pushback.
Yeah, that's something that's kind of unusual. You don't see, you see plaques in lobbies, not necessarily in the shul per se.
Right.
So you turned it around. The shul then became more financially vibrant. And since that time, what lessons did the shul learn to make sure that on a go-forward basis that doesn't happen again?
Well, there are quite a few lessons that the shul learned from this. The first was, you can do it. We started with this, and people, even old-timers at the shul told me, you're crazy. This is not a city shul. We're not going to raise that kind of money here from going to creating a campaign. You're not going to be able to do it. And a number of people really tried to discourage us. You have to just keep moving forward. You have to be persistent. You have to have tenacity. No doesn't always mean no. These are lessons that we learn. No may mean that you came at the wrong time, you know. No may mean that the person is having some difficulty right now, but in 6 months from now that could change, and you have to keep going. You know, I'll tell you a story, Steve, that I always use this story in fundraising. You know, a mashulach is sent to the U.S. from Israel to raise money for yeshiva. And he gets to New York. Everybody tells him, you have to go see this very wealthy businessman. He's the one guy. His office is in a penthouse on Park Avenue, but you have to go see him. So he goes up to see the guy. And after some small talk, he asks the guy to make a donation to the yeshiva. The guy becomes enraged. He stands up in the back of his desk. He's enraged. You come to see me for the first time, and you dare to ask me for money? And he stands up, he walks over to the fundraiser and smacks him across the face. The fundraiser slowly gets up, wipes off his face, turns to the guy and says, okay, that's what you gave me. Now what are you giving the yeshiva? And there's a lot in that story about right. tenacity and about sticking to your goal, and those are some of the lessons that we learned in this campaign.
Well, it's a great advice, because you know sometimes when you look in the order of priorities, some people will tell you that the shul is not always the number one, even though it could be the center of the community. But you know, people are caught up in their tuition and the yeshiva that their kids go to, and sometimes some pet causes, and somehow the shul gets pushed down the list, and it's not number one. So how do you change that it does become number
That's
one?
It's a good question, and it's a very slow process. That's a process of, you know, in major gift fundraising, because this was for a shul this size. This is a major gift fundraising. It's like real estate, it's location, location, location.
Yep,
in
yep.
major gift fundraising, it's cultivation, cultivation, cultivation. And it really takes a lot of cultivation. You don't always get a positive answer the first time. You have to keep educating people. You have to show people. You have to be able to demonstrate to people that your dues, while they're very, very important to the running of the shul, but they don't meet the ultimate budgetary needs that the shul needs. So you have to keep on cultivating. You know, I always remember the story. There was a study that came out at UCLA some years ago, and what they found was really quite interesting. They were on a $2 billion capital campaign to build the UCLA hospital, and they decided before going into the campaign to test what is the period of time between the time a donor gives his first donation to an organization or an institution or his shul until he gives his final donation, which is a major project, a major capital gift. And that period of time is 9.5 years.
Wow.
Nine and a half years of cultivation. That's the average time. So, you know, you have to keep those kind of things in mind, and you just have to keep educating people and talking to people and down doors.
You know what I love? I love there was a quote there when it said, there's a saying in the development profession, when it comes to major giving, there's no elevator, you must take
the
steps.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a good point. That's a great perseverance, keep going and keep going and keep going. Well, listen, you know, Ron, we could spend all day talking about what you're doing because it's so fascinating. I think
it's so interesting, Steve.
And it's so interesting for the shuls because they're facing this sometimes, especially with the economic downturn in 2008. So they were the ones on the bottom of the list. So now I think we have to work.
And that's
committed.
By the way, that's what we had also after 2008. We had a much higher percentage of people who couldn't afford to pay the dues.
Yep. No question
about
it.
That's what we were facing.
Interesting. Well, listen, Ron, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm sure everyone's going to enjoy the article, and it's great to have someone like you in the shul. I mean, I wish every shul had a professional person like you who could help them, but that would go a long way. But anyway, thank you so much. We really appreciate
Steve.
It.
I really enjoyed the conversation.
Absolutely.
And keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Be well. Bye-bye.
Okay.